Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, my three guests today are bodacious women. I love that word, bodacious. I'm sure each of them would say they're just ordinary women, but they are living extraordinary lives built around their own goals and on their own terms. And to live life on their terms, they've all had very big goals. They've been big, they've been bold, and they've been brave. And that term brave especially applies to my first guest today, and you'll find out why in just a moment. Coming up around 12:20, author Judy Blume, her books have sold more than 82 million copies, and she recently joined forces with her son, film director Lawrence Blume, to adapt one of those books. It's her first movie adaptation. They adapted Tiger Eyes. It's on the big screen right now, coming to Seattle anytime soon, we hope. And they share their journey and what they learned about each other during the interview. We'll end today's show with Lisa Renee Jones. She owned a staffing agency. She was doing very well as a business owner, named number 7 woman business entrepreneur on the Entrepreneur magazine. But she'd always wanted to have a more creative vent in her life. She started writing fiction. She became a New York Times and USA best-selling author. But the interesting thing here is that she self-published. She got her own books out there. Her latest series, or her first book of the Inside Out series, was out just 10 days before Simon & Schuster snatched it up. First, we're going to meet a grandmother who's the sole resident of the Kavik River Camp. That's 197 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Sue Akins is the sole resident there. Her address literally is a GPS coordinate. Her closest neighbor, apart from the 80-something grizzly bears within a 10-mile radius, is more than 300 miles south. She is featured in a new series by National Geographic called Life Below Zero. Fascinating, watching these people live their lives up there in the Arctic. As the series begins, Sue is returning home for the first time in several months. She had surgery on a broken ankle. She's uncertain about the conditions she's going to find when she gets home. You know, has her camp been overrun by wildlife? She says, you know, people get afraid of break-ins, but my break-ins involve teeth claws and a hell of a lot of bad weather. So I sat down. As you can imagine, she's not available via phone very often. So I pre-recorded this interview with Sue Akins. I found her fascinating. I asked her what brought her to Alaska. Why did she want to do this? She's actually been there 11 years now. So here's Sue Akins.
Well, when I was quite young, my mother was leaving my father, and about 2 in the morning, she tossed a paper bag at us and said, "Pack one bag, you're moving to Alaska." And that's what brought me to the state of Alaska. But even in preschool and kindergarten, when they would ask what I want to be when I grow up, my answer was always lighthouse keeper. I've always craved extreme isolation, and I'm pretty content there. So this was just over the, you know, I'm 50 now. Over the course of my life, I've just continually gone more extreme, and this is the natural progression.
Yeah. What is it about that extreme isolation that appeals to you? I can understand it, but I know a lot of people don't understand that.
For me, you know, even with the top predators that are out here, it's a very honest exchange of a relationship. The bear wants to eat me, I don't want it to. It's very understandable, black and white. There's never an instance where a bear is going to tell me my butt looks too big in a pair of jeans. I don't get where humans have a tendency to tear each other down and dwell on negativity. This is just an honest exchange. You get the circumstances you get. They're changing constantly, and it's a challenge. I thrive on challenges. That's where I shine. So
yeah.
I love it here.
Yeah, and I think that comes across in the show. One of the things that I'm struck by is your mindset. You say you don't allow yourself the luxury of feeling lonely. You don't allow yourself to dwell on things. You've worked hard, you say, to remove the equation of emotion, because humans connect on an emotional level, and you've worked hard to remove that equation. Tell us why.
Well, if you, that by saying that I don't dwell in an emotional place, it's not that I'm incapable. I love my children, and, I feel for them. But if, for example, I don't ever get sad. I don't dwell in feeling sad, but I do register that I may not be particularly happy at the moment. And it's just skewing your vision of things. If you allow, when you spend this amount of time 100% alone and in darkness, if you were a person that had a bent towards depression, you would go what we call bushy. Your emotional strength would break in no time flat. You need to always check and recheck yourself so that you're competent mentally.
Right.
And if you dwell too hard on the emotions, then you're not really dealing with the situation at hand.
Right. And you also say, talking of mindset, that you don't feel fear. It's just another challenge that I haven't yet faced.
Yep. The only fear that I have that I can register, like this last winter that I can remember, is I had to come in after my surgery. The doctors made me come back down for a checkup, and when I got dropped back off, the weather was so bad that the pilot had to drop me off over a mile away from camp with 900 pounds of gear. And it was dark, it was a blizzard, and I had 900 pounds to get into camp, up and over all these 20-foot drifts. And wolves were circling me. My pack has 21 in it, and they were circling me from about 200 yards out. And I tried bringing these heavy, heavy containers with me the full mile to camp, and it was too much. I mean, it was so exerting. I was throwing up on the side of the runway trying to haul all this stuff in, and I hit my wall where you cannot do it. You physically cannot do it, and I ran up against a challenge I couldn't meet. So
right.
I finally got in with my first load, and it tore me down, and I finally looked at it the right way and said, you know what, I have to agree. I cannot move 900 pounds over a mile, but I can move it 10 feet.
Right.
So I went back out, and it took me 8 hours, but I got that whole pile in by moving it 10 feet instead of 1 mile.
Right. One thing you say is one of your most important tools. You call it a tool, and that's your curiosity. And I think that really comes across in watching you out there, Sue. There are several people on the show. One of them was, quite frankly, really grumpy. But you always had this approach. I really wondered why he was living out there, because he said he chose to do it. But you had this approach that there's a wolf out there. There's a noise out there. Let's go explore. Let's go look. Tell us about your curiosity and how you keep that alive.
I kind of view myself as this eternal kindergartner that gets to run around and play in the sandbox. And it's almost hide and seek, or, king of the castle. When I do see something or hear something, I need to investigate what it is, but with the noises, the first thing you notice I do is my eyes are going around, and my ears, I move my head so I can hear. My hunting and my survival, my ears are one of my most important things. I can hear. It's so quiet here that I can hear the river, 500 yards away, and I can tell you what type of animal is walking across it, what direction they're coming from, and it all saves my life. But to me, it's just this great game of hide and seek. I do try to be careful. I have got caught with my panties down when the bear got me, and that's an experience I'll never forget. But it's definitely me against nature, and I thrive on that. And it's wonderful to get pitted against some of the most intelligent yet brutal and wonderful creatures on the planet, and even the conditions. The biggest predator I have is simply the conditions I live in.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can come out on top of that and still have 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's a pretty good feeling, and I giggle when I get ready for the next.
Right. I have to tell you, you are my new queen of sound bites. You came out with some great sound bites while you were talking to the camera. One of them, of course, referred to that weather. You say, you know, people get afraid of break-ins. My break-ins involve teeth, claws, and a hell of a lot of bad weather. And I also like this, I think, which speaks a lot to your attitude and outlook and your mindset. You say, you know, nobody can tell you, that you can't do anything. Nobody can stop you doing anything. And you say, Smokey the Bear had it right. Only you can prevent forest fires. So if your life's going up in smoke, stop dwelling on it, grab a pail of water, put that fire out and start trekking. Wonders await you. I think your attitude is just amazing, and I wonder how you keep that up. I know you said you work hard at, you know, keeping your emotions in check, but what inspires you apart from being out there in nature?
There's always something that I haven't. I may look at the same type of flower every year, but each year it's going to bloom differently. Each year, like my foxes, different ones will have kits. Every single day, you wake up every day and it's a brand new day with no mistakes in it yet. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps me going, and I accept the fact that I don't ever have to grow up unless I want to, and I'm pretty damn good at being a
I love that. I'm of that mindset too. So what is it you'd like what is it you'd like viewers to take away from looking at a slice of your life up there?
You know, and that's been asked before, and I never really thought about it. I don't look at it as I would like somebody to take something away. I would never presume to say they need to get this. Everybody, if they choose, there's something they can grab and, wow, that's cool. I guess the one thing is that you had already pointed out, come to the realization that whatever your dreams are, whatever your thoughts are, the only person in life that can tell you no, you can't, is the person in the mirror. It's not the government telling you you don't make enough, and it's not your boss telling you to be on time at work. It's the person dead in the mirror. That's the only person you're guaranteed you're going to wake up to the rest of your entire life. Make sure it's a person you can respect, and then listen to what they have to say.
Well, I think that's awesome, and I want to thank you for taking time out to talk with us today. Sue Akins, very interesting, and I like I said, you've become my new queen of soundbites, so I hope viewers enjoy your show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you can see Sue on the National Geographic show, a channel. The show is called Life Below Zero, and there are other people featured on there, too. You can find out more about that at natgotv.com/Life Below Zero. Just type in Sue Akins, and it comes up. Really interesting story, I thought, and I'd want her covering my back if I was out there in the wild, for sure. Please stay with us. We'll take a real quick break. We're going to come back with Judy Blume.
North to Alaska, go north for us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, as more Americans become displaced through hurricanes, tornadoes, and economic struggles, we examine what home really means with Sally Ooms, journalist and author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
We'll get by here, laugh and cry here, where the heart is. We are alive here, it's alive is where the heart is.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
The Rush is on.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'm going to play you an interview next that I did with Judy Blume and her son, Lawrence Blume. Again, scheduling was very tight. We had to do this very early in the morning. Judy is undoubtedly one of America's most beloved authors, I think. Her name's come up all over the place, you know, when I've been to writers' conferences. She is a longtime advocate of intellectual freedom. She actually found herself at the center of an organized book banning campaign in the 80s. And reached out to other writers as well as teachers and librarians who are under fire and has been doing great work on that ever since. She's completed, let me just tell you, she's sold more than 82 million copies of her books. 82 million. And her work has been translated into 32 languages. And she joined forces recently with her son, who's film director, Lawrence Blume. And he was named one of the top 10 rising stars of comedy by The Hollywood Reporter for his first feature film and has done some amazing work himself. He co-wrote and directed Tiger Eyes with Judy based on her bestseller, Tiger Eyes. And I'm going to play that interview to you right now. Judy Blume and Lawrence Blume. Well, I want to thank both Lawrence and Judy Blume for joining me today. Very pleased to have both of you here. And Judy, you don't know this, but your name's come up many times in conversations I've had. As I've been to several writers' conferences, I used to be on the board of the Pacific Northwest Writers' Conference, and your name was always up there. So it's nice to actually finally talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. That's very nice to hear.
And we are, of course, joined by Lawrence, who was the director of the movie. But first, before we get into the movie side of things, I just want to talk a little bit about the book and what inspired the book Tiger Eyes.
Well, if you ask me now, I would give you probably a different answer than I would have given you when I was writing it, because when I was writing it, I'm not sure how much I knew, how much was coming from deep inside me, but that's the way it always is with a novel. So it was inspired by a move to New Mexico, 2 years living in the town of Los Alamos. A lot of personal unhappiness while I was there, and a story that I had heard about a family who lost their beloved father and who relocated to live with well-meaning but helicopter-type relatives in another place, and I thought, that's an interesting idea. I think I'll write that story. And it wasn't until I saw the movie on the big screen that I realized how much must have come from the loss of my own father when I was young. I wasn't as young as Davy. I was 21. And then ultimately realizing what my father would have wanted for me, which was to embrace life and live life to the fullest.
Yes, I think that's true of fathers. Do you, I mean, you seem to have universal themes throughout all of your books. Are most of them drawn on personal experience?
You know, you ask that question of any fiction writer, and I would say no, but we all write about things we know. We all, you know, bring up what's deep inside. We don't even know where it is. Sometimes we don't even understand it. And then we read a book that we've written and we say, wow, oh, I know where that came from now. But so they're not autobiographical. I have one book that's really autobiographical, and that's starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. And that's fiction. But it's the book that's most like my own family.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking of family, what a talented family you do have, because I read that you've sold over 82 million copies of your books. Lawrence Bloom, of course, is your son, and he was named one of the 10 rising stars of comedy by The Hollywood Reporter for a film that he made called Martin and Olaf. So, Lawrence, were you influenced going into film by any of your mom's work at all?
Not specifically. I think maybe the fact that my mother was an artist, and I got to see that you can create things and maybe make a living at it gave me some inspiration. The fact that she was incredibly supportive of me choosing a profession that is so difficult to kind of break into. I suppose there was an artistic feeling around, but no, I think it's just something I kind of fell into and wanted to pursue.
Right. And so what inspired you to work with your mom as a director? I read that this is the number one question you're both asked is, what was it like to work with mother and son?
Well, we're still here. That's good.
And we still each other.
We do still like each other. It was a great pleasure. I mean, the inspiration originally was that I had read the book when I was a teenager when it first came out, and it was a very personal story for me and reflected things that were going on in my own life, and so I always felt very close to it, and it was the New Mexico landscape that I was living in then, so I always had a vision for it in some way and wanted to make it to a movie. I had no idea it would take 30 years of doing other things before it finally would happen, but it was just a beautiful accident that this was the right time and place, and getting to collaborate with Judy was just, it was really a pleasure.
And that's pretty cool if you've had that vision in your head since you were a kid, too.
It is, and it's funny, too, because it changes. If somebody had allowed me to make the movie when I was 25, it would be a completely different movie than I made in my 40s, you know, because life, you know, you learn a lot about life, and I think in some way I'm really glad it finally happened now and not earlier, because it's a deep story of deep emotion, and trying to realize those emotions on screen and trying to put that all together with some of the perspective of being around for a while, I think was really helpful. So I'm glad it was now.
Right. Now, so the book, Judy obviously wrote, but I believe you co-wrote the screenplay, is that correct?
We did it. Yeah, we did it together.
We did it together. Yeah, mm-hmm. We did.
So tell us about that.
We screenplay together. We cast the movie together. She sat next to me on the set every single day for every shot. It was really as close a collaboration on a movie as you could have.
Yeah, and Judy, from your perspective as a writer, I'm guessing that was pretty awesome, because often novelists, when they turn their book over or the screenplay over, that's the last word they have to say on anything.
I know. This was so different. And, I mean, for better or worse, and I think, you know, for the better part of it is that we did have, we really did have creative control over this, something that almost never happens. But the trade-off is that it was a very small budget and there's no studio behind us for advertising or marketing or getting the word out. So we have to do that ourselves with the help of people like you who are helping us, you know, get the word out that this exists.
Right. Now, I read from a writer's perspective, it is very different to actually do a screenplay. What were the difficulties for you, Judy, in that? And then I want to know from Lawrence's perspective as a director and co-writer, his difficulties there, his challenges.
Well, I'm not a screenwriter. I mean, I don't think I'm a natural screenwriter the way I'm a natural novelist. I have written other screenplays, but, you know, most of them haven't gone anywhere. But so I kind of knew. But I'm structure is not my strong point. It's Larry's strong point. And he was the one who brought structure to the story. And I bring, you know, my talent, if I have one, is the dialogue and the characters and the relationship.
And so, Lawrence, from a director's point of view, you're co-writing, and as your mum just said, you're more structured. I read she's very organic about the way she approaches her writing. Presumably, were you storyboarding? I mean, how were you working on that?
I only storyboard action sequences when you have to communicate a lot of very specific frames to a crew, but I have it all in my head, and I make shot lists, but, you know, really, it's a process of, you know, most of the images came to me either laying around the house writing the screenplay or scouting locations and taking a lot of pictures and studying them, and then once you have the cast and you kind of figure out what they can do and can't do and how they look, and you know, it's sort of an organic process, but you know, I was trying to capture the spirit of the book and be as faithful as I could, but at the same time turn it into, you know, a motion picture which has images and sounds, and use all the tools you have available as a filmmaker to convey the same emotional story.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask you if you learned anything new about your mom while you were working on this. What did you learn about Judy that maybe you didn't know before or understand before?
That she has an unbelievable amount of energy, and that she can go and go and go and go and go, and I had to struggle to keep up with her. I still do.
That's cute. There were these carved in stone ancient steps when we were in the canyon, often covered with snow, leading up to where we had our porta potties. And yes, the crew was very impressed that at my age I was able to trudge up and down those steps. But as I say in the little edition I wrote for the new edition of the book, The Making of Tiger Eyes, I say that I stopped drinking so much tea once I realized what I was going to have to do.
That's funny. And so I'd like
I have to say, too, I one of the things I've taken from watching Judy work is a very pure sense of the creative and what the thing is actually about. Because I think when you're on a movie, there's always a lot of voices around telling you to cut this or change that, or, you know, things that are very practical for the movie or maybe the marketers. But to stay focused and inside the story you're telling, despite all the pressures that are going on around you, it was really a kind of a gift to watch her operate. And no matter what was happening around us, you know, I could ask her a question about the story, and she was right deep into the story with that same level of integrity that was pure to the story, having nothing to do with, you know, the problems that were happening around us.
Right.
Something that, you know, is something probably every filmmaker has to learn how to do in their own way.
Right, right. And a lot of passion she brought by the sound of it, too. Judy, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Lawrence. And what did you learn about Lawrence get a deeper understanding of?
I was just, now see, you'll make me cry. You know, this is my child. Even though we're working, and we're working as adults, and we're working as equals, Larry and Judy, but still, to see your son be able to do this was just, well, it was really wonderful to see that. I was very, very proud of him, even the times when I would get angry at him, which were only one or two times the whole time we were shooting.
He was so able
to pull this off. He was able to do this 23 days, and he brought it in on time and on budget, under budget, I think. And working with the actors and, you know, very, very quietly, getting the actors to do what he needed them to do to tell the story. I'd never really been on a set like that before, so I had never seen this happen, and it's very impressive. And the person who's responsible, who is the director, is under a tremendous amount of pressure. Pressure, yes. Larry says, yeah, the reason you enjoyed being on the set so much, Judy, is that you weren't responsible for bringing it in on time and on budget. And it's true. On the set, all the responsibility was on his shoulders. And yet, he made it happen.
Right. And I read you only had 23 days to shoot that, Lawrence. Did you make it in the 23 days?
Yes, we did.
Awesome.
We had no choice.
Well, it's true. When when somebody comes along and says, we didn't have a studio behind us, but we had a big company, but their attitude was, this is the amount of money we've got. There isn't any more. So when things, when things go right, great. When things go wrong, too bad. Work it out. So there was a lot of pressure, and in that short a schedule to try and shoot multiple big emotional scenes in one day. Not the easiest thing in the world, but you just, be as prepared as you can and just flow with it when things don't go as planned, it's hard.
We had the most cooperative, I would even say loving, supportive crew and cast, everyone working together to make this project happen. I think it was just a good feeling on our set, and everybody cared deeply.
That's awesome.
And the guy who made me my little girl cheese sandwiches every day was the nicest man in the world.
Yeah. Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left. I know I have to let you go. So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'm just thrilled to be able to finally share this film with everybody, and I'm also thrilled that, we're playing in every living room in America starting tomorrow. If you can't get to a local theater, it's not playing in the theater where you are. We hope you come see it in the theater, but if not, the fact that it's on cable, satellite, iTunes, video on demand, that'll be available everywhere to all of Judy's fans, and we hope they like it, and we encourage them to come to Facebook and to communicate with us and pass the word around.
Awesome. Lawrence Bloom, Judy Bloom, thank you both so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And welcome back, everyone. Of course, that was Lawrence Bloom and Judy Bloom talking about their collaboration, mother-son collaboration, on bringing Judy's book Tiger Eyes to the big screen. And you can find out more about that at tigereyesmovie.com, tigereyesmovie.com. I love that Lawrence referred to his mom as she's got so much energy. She was outlasting everyone. She's around 75 years old. So if you think you're too old to accomplish a dream here, I mean, who thinks of making a movie at the age of 75? I think that's awesome. If you missed any of that, you can catch links to it at Facebook, our Facebook conversationslive.net. It links out to the trailer. And I think Judy's on Twitter at Judy Bloom, and the movie, again, tigereyesmovie.com. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by New York Times bestselling author Lisa Renee Jones. But before we zip off to break, I want to just let everybody know, last week we had Susan Wiggs join us. She was a number one New York Times bestselling author. She's been on the NYT and USA bestselling author list many, 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 many times. And we have 5 books to give away, which we're drawing tomorrow, Tuesday the 18th at noon Pacific. We already have a lot of entries, but you still have time to enter. If you'd like to enter, you can do that by leaving a voicemail at my 800 number, 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email info@conversationslive.net, and just put Susan Wiggs giveaway in there. The book is called The Apple Orchard. It's a great summer read, and it's doing exceptionally well. And Susan Wiggs, of course, is right here on one of the islands off Seattle. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with you. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You
you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the best odor neutralizer for cat urine ever, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, June 23rd, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. I'll have open phone lines for your calls and questions, plus more talk about the huge upcoming Canine Science Conference happening soon in Redmond. Find out how you can attend in person or watch it at home for free. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Enjoy your food, but eat less. A simple way to eat less is to be mindful of what you're eating. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Eat slowly and enjoy the taste and texture of your food. Use hunger and fullness as cues to recognize when you've had enough. Healthy meals start with fruits, vegetables, and smaller portions of proteins and grains. And don't forget to choose low-fat or fat-free dairy. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Visit eatright.org for more healthy tips.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
There's nothing else like it on the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Lisa Renee Jones. She's the author of the highly acclaimed Inside Out trilogy, which sold to more than 10 countries and has been optioned by Starz Network for a cable television show. I think I'm going to bring Lisa on and let her share the rest of her background with us because it's very interesting. She went from a strong businesswoman in one area to a strong businesswoman in a whole different area. Lisa Renee Jones, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to just start out by sharing more of your background here because, as I said, it's very interesting. You were a successful entrepreneur. You had a staffing agency, went across multiple states. So very much involved in the corporate world there. What was going on at that time in your life and what made you want to make a switch?
Well, I actually started out when I was younger doing a lot of film. I actually did some independent films. I was living, my home is Austin, Texas, or my hometown. Now I'm in Colorado. And so that's a very, you know, film-oriented. And then later, my son got involved in acting, and I mean, to the point that he got a scholarship to Actors Studio, that kind of thing. So I think it kind of sparked that coming back to me. I mean, I had kids and got away from it, but I always had that creative part of me that was dying to come back out. And there was a point where I had a chance to say either I was going to sell my business to a bigger company and stay on for 5 years. They offered me a lot of money to stay on for 5 years, or I could leave and right. kind of somewhat be starting over. And I thought, you know, if I wait much longer, I might be so old that I think I'm not going to have the courage to do it. So, I mean, a lot of people thought I was insane, but I walked away from that and took the risk to taste the dream.
Yeah. So tell us what the dream looked like back then. I'm sure it evolved over time, and I know some things changed over time, but what did it look like back then when you quit?
The industry has changed so much since I started writing. I mean, it actually, if you look back, you can see that where we are right now had started happening just barely started happening then, because when I first started writing, there were the first small e-publishing companies had just sprouted. And a lot of people thought, oh, that's not going to go anywhere. But then Laura's Cave proved that it absolutely could go somewhere. They became a mega hit. And e-publishing started, you know, this path that eventually led to the indie publishing, where authors are self-publishing their books, you know, big names even, you know, doing that. So that's what it looked like then. But there wasn't a lot of money in it for an author. You were still like the starving artist when you were doing that. You certainly got the chance to get to some readers and to learn your craft. But I delved into that, and I pretty quickly signed on with Harlequin and started writing category romances at that point.
Mm. You say that you managed to get published fairly quickly, but it was a long time before you actually made a decent living at publishing. And let's just talk about the book that I have in my hand right now. It's called If I Were You. It's part of the Inside Out trilogy, and that's been described as 50 Shades of Grey meets Basic Instincts with a little Storage Wars mystery thrown in. So tell us, let's start with the Storage Wars first, because that's an interesting story about how your fiance got into that situation.
Yeah, you know, actually, I was writing for Harlequin, and I was doing some stuff with Laura's Cave and just some small publishers, and, you know, really was not making a lot of money at it. But, I mean, so people would see my books on the shelf, and they think, oh, she's a published author, she must be making lots of money. No, less than school teacher pay, and writing lots of books every year. And my fiance was a physical therapist, and he basically got surprised when they got shut down for taxes one day. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, my gosh, we need money. And I'd seen this piece online about storage units, and this was before Storage Wars ever existed. And I'm like, you know, he's very into collectibles and stuff, and I thought, you should go try it and see what happens. And he did. And, oh, God, I thought it was probably going to break us up because we agreed to spend $300. Yeah, we agreed, $300, no more. He spent $800. I mean, seriously, I was freaking out. But we made like $3,000 in a week.
So wow.
We were hooked, completely hooked. And so thus it began. And it was buying units, and I would have a word count goal every day. I have to write this many words, but then I have to do this much, dig through the units and find the valuable things and list them on eBay or whatever. And this was just like this, oh my gosh, 9-day cycle. We were working our backsides off. But, you know, it's so funny how you can look back and see how maybe there's this greater plan that's happening that you don't even realize is happening, because those tough times when we started doing those storage auctions, you know, that's when he found a journal. And he never gets sick, but this particular day, he'd bought like 3 huge truckloads of stuff, and he got it all loaded in, and he just happened to grab this spiral-bound notebook out of a box, and he brought it in and laid on the couch. We had a really tiny place, and my desk was like behind the couch, and I'm sitting there writing, and he's laying there going, you know, oh my God, she's pregnant again. And, oh, you know, I still remember him sitting up and going, somebody got murdered next door. They called 911. It was hilarious because he's a guy. They don't normally, you know.
So somebody has a much more interesting journal than my journal.
Yeah, that's what I said too. Mine would be like grocery store, you know, need shampoo. Yeah, it was interesting, and so he got it in his mind then that I had to write something that was suspenseful, that was wrapped around the journal found in the storage unit, and it had to be sexy because that's what I do. And at the time, I mean, I was digging through boxes and listing on eBay, and I had Harlequin contracts. I'm like, yeah, I'll get to that. And he just kept on and on and on for years. And I started forming ideas and started jotting down notes, and he kept at me about it. And, you know, I think actually it was good because I got to know the characters. I have this huge arc that I created. I didn't just do it because there was a deadline. It was because I got really passionate about the characters in the story. And it all worked out. And I also think that I became a better writer in that time. Just everything was right. And then Storage Wars came along and 50 Shades came along. And all of a sudden, my story fit into those from a marketing standpoint.
Right.
It was magic.
Now, as you said, it didn't happen overnight. You actually had an editor very interested in it. She wanted her boss to read it. That took about a year. You then start negotiating with another editor and publisher, don't like the deal on that, and so decide to self-publish.
Yeah, actually what happened was I had written just a partial of it, and I had given it to my agent, and it sat on a desk forever, and the editor ended up really liking it, but that line that it would have fit in was being shut down. And I was like, great, I can't believe this. It sat there for a year, and this is what's happened. Well, in that year, 50 Shades was published. So it was like, okay, and I'd already written more of it at that point. She had three chapters of it, but it was like, okay, 50 Shades has now been published, so it had this marketing edge. And I had finished the book, and I decided, my agent basically said, I just don't think it's going to sell anywhere because of the way the market shifted. And I'm like, I don't believe that. I don't believe it. So I contacted an editor that I knew who read it and was like, yes, we want it. But I didn't like the money, and I didn't like the changes they wanted me to make to it, because I felt like one of the problems that I think that traditional publishing has had in the past, and one of the reasons why I think people are responding so well to a lot of the self-published material that you see getting picked up by publishers later, is that traditional publishing has always told us, no, people cannot die, no, people cannot cheat, no, people cannot have these bad things happen in their life. We don't want people to have to experience those things. But it's not a matter of not getting to happily ever after. It's a matter of, I think, people need to believe in the story, and right, that it's possible to really get to happily ever after, because let's face it, bad things happen in life. And I wanted the stories to reflect that. Yeah, I wanted the stories to reflect that. And I think that that's what happens in indie publishing, is that, you know, we're telling those real stories. So I decided, no, I'm not going to take the deal. And at that point, I needed an agent who believed in the story and who also would sell foreign rights for indie publishing, because mine wouldn't. So I found Louise Fury, and she was like, you know, I never take on just foreign rights, but I've read your books, your other books. I like your books. I'll take you on for foreign rights. And then I sent her If I Were You, and I said, this is my baby. This is the one I think you can sell lots of foreign rights on, I hope. And she read it, and she said, oh, my God, Lisa, please let me take this to some New York houses. And at that point, I'd already put a whole marketing plan together. I'd been advertising. I had a release date that was a hard release date. And I said, I'm self-publishing it, period. If you want to take it to a few people, fine. But I also had been self-publishing another series that had done very well. I'd made enough money that I knew that I think probably at that point I was making as much money in a month on my indie publishing as I'd been making in a year the prior years. So I didn't feel like I had to take a New York deal.
Right, right.
But anyway, so from there, before I ever self-published it, we got into a bidding war, and then I self-published it for like 14 days.
And then so a gallery took over. Simon & Schuster took over.
Yeah.
This is the story that is, I think, really inspiring to many people. Like, I know many people. I know you talked to, you know, Bella Andre, who we talked with last week, same kind of situation with her. Self-publishing led to great success. But I'm wondering, you know, she had a very strong business background. You had a very strong business background. I'm wondering if you look back now, you know, do you think you'd have had the same kind of success without that business background?
No, I don't, because I mean, when I first delved into publishing, the one thing that I felt like I needed to do was go to conventions and learn. I mean, I felt like I was an expert in the staffing field because that's what I had done. I wanted to be an expert in publishing, which it's ever-changing. I don't know if you can ever be an expert, which also means that you have to be ever-changing. And I think one thing about business that I learned was what goes up must go down. Opportunities that come will pass, but all other doors will open. And also that this is a business. It's about making money. And, you know, when I teach classes on indie publishing and on traditional publishing and how to mix them together, I tell authors to get over the problem of thinking about this as, oh, I just want my books on the shelf. It's okay to want to make a living at this. The publishers want to make a living, but you also have to understand that, too. They're in this to make money. How can you make them money? It doesn't matter how much they love the books. Ultimately, there's a big corporation behind those books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to look at your own self that same way as a business who wants to make money. And no business stays the same and makes money. They have to look at what's going on and adjust. And I don't mean write books just for the market. No, I definitely don't mean that. But I mean, with indie publishing, there's all kinds of things that you have to watch and look to decide how should you be placing your books. Is this cover working? Is this thing working? I mean, there's things I look at all the time. And I know when I talk to other authors that are successful at this, they say they spend about 40% of their time on the business marketing end
right.
of things. And I definitely do.
Right, right. Yeah, bottom line, I mean, you have to stay relevant. It doesn't matter what business you're in, creative, scientific, you've got to stay relevant. I want to ask you, because we don't have a great deal of time left, but I want to ask you, you write some steamy sex scenes in your book. Is that difficult for you to do? Do you feel like people are looking at you? And I ask that because I have a friend who writes erotica, and sometimes I look at her and I'm like, I don't want to know what you're writing.
When my fiance was reading Be and Me, the second book, he looked at me, he's like, you wrote this? I'm like, yes. Some of those scenes take me forever to write because, one, they're pushing me. They're pushing the limits. If they're not pushing me and not pushing the limits, then they're not taking the reader on the journey that I want to. But also, I don't want it to just be sex. I want there to be an emotional reason that no matter how hot it is, no matter what is happening in that scene, there's an emotional component to it. And I hope that in this series, that's one thing that people will leave saying, that they had an emotional roller coaster ride, that they felt passionate about it. So I don't care whether there's a flogger involved or what it might be. It's got to have an emotional reason why that flogger is in that scene.
Right. And in like 30 seconds, 45 seconds, can you give us just a synopsis of If I Were You?
You find a journal and a storage unit. It leads you on a mystery that is very Pretty Little Liars or Lost-like, with a lot of passion.
There we go. And where can our listeners find out more about you, Lisa?
It's LisaReneeJones.com, and I'm at LisaReneeJones on Twitter. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook all the time. I'm very active with my fans.
Okay. And I know that's where you've got a lot of your feedback to make your books even better. So important interaction there.
Yeah, I love my fans. If without them, I wouldn't have be able to write books. So thanks to them.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Enjoy talking with you. And Lisa's book, again, it's the first in the trilogy, the Inside Out series, rather. It's called If I Were You. And, some steamy sex scenes in there, some good summer reading, if that's what you enjoy. And you can find out more about Lisa and her other books at LisaReneeJones.com, LisaReneeJones.com. And I want to thank you for being with us today. Don't forget that if you haven't entered the drawing for the Susan Wiggs giveaways, we've got 5 books, which we'll be giving away at noon Pacific tomorrow. You can enter the drawing still by calling our 800 number, 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, and we have 5 hardback copies of The Apple Orchard. Susan Wiggs, of course, #1 New York Times bestselling author who lives right here on the islands off of Seattle. All right, that's it for today's show. I thank you for being with us, and you can find out more at our website, conversationslive.net. You can find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and you can find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you spending this hour with us, and we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, as more Americans become displaced through hurricanes, tornadoes, and economic struggles, we examine what home really means with Sally Ooms, journalist and author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
We'll get by here, laugh and cry here, where the heart.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.